You're listening to a podcast from the Media Motel. Coming up this week in episode 304. Election ennui. Is this it, or will it heat up before June the 8th? Juliet has been to Sheffield to cheer on Ronnie O'Sullivan at the Crucible. And we ask, is snooker the politest sport on the planet? And in the modern era, when do we become old? Does age even matter in the new millennium? Oh, I look forward to hearing about this. It's all coming up after Jake Bogg and Lightning Bolt.
Morning, it's another pure grey morning. Don't know what the day is holding. And I get up right home and I walk right into the path of a lightning bolt. Siren of an ambulance comes howling right through the centre of town. And one blinks an eye and I look up to the sky for the path of a lightning bolt. As the angels parted for her, she only brought me torture. That's what happens when it's you that's standing in the path of a lightning bolt. Everyone I see just walks the walk with gritty teeth, but I just stand by and I wait my time. They say you gotta toe the line. They want the wall and not the wine. But when I see the signs, I'll jump on that line. Chances, people tell you not to take chances, and they'll tell you that there aren't any answers. And I was starting to agree, but I woke suddenly in the path of a lightning bolt. Fortune, people talking all about fortune. Do you make it or does it just call you? In the blinking of an eye, just another passerby in the path of a lightning bolt. Everyone I see just walks the walk with gritty teeth, but I just stay. I was lying back gazing skyward when the moment got shattered. I remember what she said and then she fled in the path of a lightning bolt.
Rather cheery opening. Now, we will obviously talk about different things in the podcast. For reasons that will become apparent, Terence begged me not to pick Snooker Loopy. So I picked this instead, which was playing on the tannoy loudly as I waited to watch a snooker match this week. It's also, I have a joke with a friend of mine that he dislikes the slightly sort of laddish end of indie that I quite enjoy. And the sort of thing that one wears a Fred Perry to listen to, kind of Britpop revival stuff. And I have a little Spotify playlist called Radio Lad as a result, and this would very much be on Radio Lad. It got to number 26 in 2012 from the silver selling album Jake Bugg. That was Jake Bugg and a lightning bolt.
One of seven singles taken from his first album. It's quite remarkable.
To be fair, it's a very strong album. It's a sort of album which, when you listen to it all the way through, it is very singalonger, if you see what I mean. So I can see why they got so many singles from it.
He's a good advertisement for the BBC Introducing Initiative, isn't he?
Because
that was, you know, as the name suggests, it showcases unsigned and emerging talent, and that's where he got his break. Yeah.
And somewhat ironically, like you say, the BBC, he sort of was broken through that. Mm. And his single Trouble Town, which was from that album, was the theme for Happy Valley, the BBC TV series that was broadcast in 2014 and 2016.
Ah, well, welcome to the Parish Council podcast. It is indeed episode 304. I'm Terence Stackham, and back from a few days watching the World Snooker Championship in Sheffield is Juliet Harris.
Hello, indeed I am a snooker loopy, even though I'm not allowed to choose that song.
No,
you're such a fascist, Terence.
I was thinking of all of us. I wasn't just thinking of me, I was thinking of everybody listening.
When Ken Livingstone was talking about Hitler, really, Terence, he was talking about you.
Here in the UK, following the recent announcement, it's been a week of excitement and dramatic updates, but enough about the Bananarama reunion tour.
Oh, we're all living for that, surely.
In terms of the general election, it's continuing, in my view, to be underwhelming. About this time last year, I gave a very unscientific prediction for the European referendum vote based on the number of placards and signs I'd seen in the Berkshire and Surrey area.
But it probably wasn't wrong, was it?
It was. It was about 10 to 1 in favour of leaving the EU in terms of the placards and whatnot. So far in this general election, in the campaign, I've only seen one set of placards which are next to the M25 between Chertsey and Weybridge, and they're supporting UKIP, so I don't think that tells us very much. But perhaps as we get closer to June the 8th, everything will get a bit more interesting. This week, so far, the only point of interest that for me is hardly a highlight was Boris Johnson emerging from anonymity so far in the campaign, suddenly turn up on Breakfast TV, Radio 4, 5 Live and LBC, all in the space of an hour this morning, which he used to make sort of ageist comments about Jeremy Corbyn. Are you engaged with this election yet, Jules?
I wish it wasn't happening, I have to say. I'd nicely summed up. I mean, maybe all the chaos happened at the beginning. I would recommend, and occasionally I recommend Twitter follows, Jennifer Williams with the Manchester Evening News, their political correspondent, tweets, and it's a reasonably sized regional paper. And she's got interesting things to say. She's a good Twitter follow, I think. She tweets as Jen Williams MEN. And her tweet... at 20 past 8 in the evening on April the 19th, 2017. Election diary day one. Osborne resigns. Joan election rubber stamped. Gorton by-election cancelled. Theresa May launches in Bolton. Day one. And I think, in a way, lots of things happen very quickly. And then, I mean, it's longer than normal short campaign, in that the normal short campaign is about 5 weeks, I think, roughly. It's just over a month. Whereas this one will have an extra, it's 7 weeks in total, I think someone worked it out at, which is long anyway, particularly long given that all of the polls indicate that it might well be a foregone conclusion. I know that Jeremy Corbyn and Labour are fighting very hard against that. But that, I think, is what makes it difficult. I mean, the last election was genuinely on it, was seen to be on a knife edge. Whereas this one, not so much, one would argue. I mean, there are still the one thing that entertained me, I think it was announced last night, but I think I saw it this morning, was people are often dismissing Labour at the moment as being a bit of a zombie party, as being a party that is probably on the way out but just won't die and is keeping going. In a way, I feel that in another, there's another party for whom the general election is probably likely to be Night of the Living Undead, and that is Tories that have lost their seats, that are now, because and of course they, and this has happened, but all the major parties are doing this. The Lib Dems seem to have prepared for an early election by selecting candidates sort of for about a year or so. Everyone else taken by surprise, but we've been told repeatedly by Labour Hype Command that they're ready for a snap election. And then on the day it was called, there was no campaign budget in place. There's no manifesto till May the 15th. It doesn't necessarily demonstrate that they were ready. But anyway, but because it's a short time and, you know, selections are really difficult to organise, actually, and they take a lot of time and a lot of money, crucially. If you're having to do that 636 times, which I think is, it's either 626 or 636, that's the number of seats nationally. Instead, Labour, and I think the Tories as well, have taken a fairly sensible decision that it will be the National Executive Committee that selects, that long lists and then short lists and then selects for each area. And people from each area have you know, locally, there is a local person on the panel usually, but it is a central panel. There's a lot of unseemly horse trading within Labour at the moment between the different wings of the party. And I've been most amused that the Corbynites, having moaned about Blair and Blairite parachuting in of candidates, are now attempting to do the same thing, and quite a lot of Mr. Corbyn's office workers want seats in places. So the Tories are doing similar things. So the Night of the Living Undead, Esther McVeigh lost her seat. One of the Liverpool seats. My friend Susan was particularly aerated by her and pleased she lost her seat. So it was announced that, last night, that she has now been selected to fight George Osborne's former seat of Tacton.
Unbelievable.
George Osborne having I've finally been persuaded to, that perhaps doing every job in the world, as well as being an MP, wasn't a great look, and he was stood down. Apparently, he wasn't put off by the fact that editing a major newspaper with a daily edition was an issue. He thought that people would find it hard to stomach the fact that he had a £600,000 job at BlackRock. Mm. I mean, none of it's ideal, really, is it? But anyway, yes, all the kind of unseemly infighting, is. I think this is going to be an election to forget, frankly, not just in terms of the outcome. But, I mean, Boris Johnson sums it up, I think, this morning, and actually it was really worrying, because I was in a hotel this morning and we were checking out at lunchtime, so we kind of had a fairly easy morning, and we watched the Victoria Derbyshire show, which I have to say we've watched several times this week, and I think is excellent on BBC2. It wasn't with Victoria Derbyshire this morning, it was with someone, another lady, but they have interviews of people and it was quite interesting. And one thing I noticed, actually, and the Today footage of Boris Johnson was played over and over again. I woke up this morning and read the word mugwump and thought, what the hell? I mean, he made this comment about him. It was a typical, my friend said, do you remember Linton Crosby's Dead Cat Bounce? And for overseas viewers, Linton Crosby is an Australian political strategist, and I suspect not terribly nice person, yes, don't sue me, libel lawyers, but, you know, that's the impression one gets. Anyway, he runs unpleasant campaigns that have dog whistles in them, so I think it's a fair conclusion to draw. And he won the 2015 election for the Conservatives, though he was in charge of their campaign, and he's very much a fan of what they call the dead cat strategy, which is people are talking about something and you fling a dead cat on the table, and it's unseemly and it's unpleasant and it's not very nuanced campaigning. But once you've done that, all that anybody ever does is talk about the dead cat on the table. So, for example, Ed Miliband's bacon sandwich or the Michael Fallon made call, or whoever it was, whichever MP it was, that said, oh, how could Ed Miliband stab his own brother in the back? And it was a ridiculous thing to say, and that's all that anybody talked about. So Boris Johnson threw his dead mugwump onto the table, and everyone was alarmed about that. But in that same interview, basically said that we probably couldn't refuse to help America if they wanted our help in Syria, and he wasn't willing to commit to the fact that would have to go through Parliament.
That was terrifying, wasn't it?
And actually, whilst everyone's talking about the mugwump, and the mugwump was in an article in The Sun, and then he made those comments on Radio 4 today this morning after they'd done the paper review with The Sun. This has got the hands of Linton Crosby all over it, and also it's got Boris Johnson's unpleasantness. I mean, I find him to be a repulsive figure, because it's this kind of Billy Bunter-esque kind of oh ho ho what fun kind of front to it all, and you know there's something really unpleasant going on underneath, I think. And so yes, that was my the reason why no one is terribly infused by this election campaign is. You've got rubbish like that going on, where at one level you've got this kind of tedious yaboo kind of stuff that puts people off politics, masking really quite terrifying, authoritarian, troubling things. And of course, if Mrs. May does win by a huge majority, which I think she probably will, I mean, Labour have made some ground up on the polls, not very much, but some. The Tories have done their first Corbyn is a security risk video online, which is devastating, because all it does is show footage of him saying things at rallies, on telly, on all sorts of things. And it is devastating, because all it does is use his own words. They don't make any inferences. They just play the footage. And that's, you know, always been one of my big worries about that. So, I mean, this campaign is going to be nasty. It's going to be unpleasant. It's probably going to be one of the most unpleasant campaigns in recent memory. And I say that after the bacon sandwich Jewish dog whistles of the last election, frankly. That was my big problem with the bacon sandwich thing. Look at this Jewish guy that can't eat bacon. You know, I felt that was a big thing to that. So I'm finding it hard. The only thing that is exciting me about this election is some people that I know and some friends of mine and some more moderate people are being selected as candidates in good seats. And that's, I'm looking forward to kind of the new people of Labour that will have to pick the mess up, basically.
And mentioning Mr. Corbyn has been saying, Mrs. May had a public appearance today where she failed to answer questions from journalists. One aspect of the election that has changed this time round is that Mrs. May has said that she won't appear on any televised debates with the other party leaders. Now, I expected there to be more criticism of her for that, but that seems to have just drifted along as well. Are you in favour of these televised debates?
Well, I have to say, I'm having an issue with my microphone. I said previously that I was very pleased by the reappearance of the Daily Mirror chicken and it's chasing people. I'm sorry it hasn't chased Theresa May, actually. Maybe that's coming. I don't know. But Theresa May, people say, oh, it's awful, it's dreadful, you know, she won't do these TV debates. TV debates are a new phenomenon. The reason the Mirror chicken existed in the first place is that no one would do them for ages and ages and ages. And it was only a David Cameron era thing that they came in, and the infamous I agree with Nick debate. Basically, the Conservative campaign, and this is borne out by the thing that I've just talked about with the video, is to let Labour do the talking. I think that is the hallmark of this campaign. We will hear, apart from Boris being Boris, we will hear very little, I think, from Theresa May and most senior Tories in this campaign, because we don't need to. They don't need to have very much of a manifesto when they've got an enormous lead, having not offered many policies so far. And so there, I think their approach is just, you know, talk little, say a lot, I think, really. And also, Theresa May, I think she doesn't need to do them. And if she doesn't need to do them, then she's not going to. Because I think she and the people around her are fly enough to realise that the only reason that she comes out on top in Prime Minister's questions is that Corbyn is so poor. And we have seen from Yvette Cooper's occasional interventions, which we discussed previously, that Yvette's had a couple of big questions at PMQs where she's absolutely slaughtered Theresa May. And the last time she did it, you could genuinely see Theresa May looking quite worried when Yvette Cooper was speaking. And actually, if Theresa May was up against someone decent, I think she would suffer. I think she realises that she's not a politician that thinks on her feet. I mean, for all of my insults of, you know, my dislike of David Cameron Osborne, they were far lighter of foot than Theresa May. Theresa May, I think one of her great appeals to people, and to middle England particularly, is she is a grafter made good. And that's how she came to be the Conservative leader. She was the one that was left standing to clear the mess up. She wasn't necessarily the flair of Boris or of Gove or of anyone like that. She wasn't flamboyant, but she grafted and she was the tortoise rather than the hare. And I think that she's not someone who necessarily can be very quick-witted. She has to have lines written for her, I think. Her strengths, such as they are, lie in other areas, I think. And I think that, you know, we're in a situation where, because there is, you know, no real threat from the opposition, you know, even they say, oh, the poll lead's been reduced, they're only leading by 16 points now. And you go, oh, only. I'm liking the use of this expression, only. That's you know, it would be enjoyable if it wasn't so terrible from my point of view. TV debates, I mean, I can see why, you know, people say, oh, isn't it disgusting that she doesn't do them? They're a recent thing. It's her choice to do them or not, ultimately. And she's made the not, you know, the pragmatic decision that she's probably not great at them. And she's in a position where she doesn't have to do them.
Yeah.
And because she's winning by so far, by such a large margin, she's so far in front.
I think she's the epitome of that cliche, a safe pair of hands from the
Conservatives. Well, exactly. I don't think she is that safe, actually. I'm not entirely convinced she knows what she's doing.
I think that's how she got the job, though, by being seen as that.
As we said earlier, this is the one. It was in the musical chairs that was that summer. She was the one that was left standing passed the parcel. She was the one that held the parcel and tore off the last layer when the music stopped.
In recent years,
we've yet to learn.
In recent years, I feel these TV debates have been arranged more for the convenience of the TV companies and perhaps even the egos of the presenters or interviewers. And I felt little of value has emerged as the leaders. They're all terrified of saying something that might be in any way controversial, and I think that example of Ed Miliband, who stumbled off stage at the BBC debate in 2015, and that got, you know, all the coverage rather than anything he said. So
yeah,
I won't miss the TV debates at all.
No, I won't.
Juliet's been to Yorkshire and survived. That's next after Belle and Sebastian.
Another sunny day, I met you up in the garden. You were digging plants, I took you, beg your pardon. I took a photograph. kiss my eye, I wonder why I didn't complain. You miss my eye, I wonder why, please do it again. But loving is a mess, what happened to all of those feelings?
All of the feelings,
I thought it was real, baby's rings and fourth kneeling. Haunting the heart.
From their splendid 2006 album, The Life Pursuit, that's Belle and Sebastian, and Another Sunny Day.
That's so nice. That's a nice cut from that album, actually, I think.
Yeah, it is. I love Belle and Sebastian. Probably about time we had a new album from them, I think, really.
Well, we had one a year or two ago, I think, because I went to see them, years. I think. Yeah.
Now, very bravely this week, you went to what geographers and cartographers call up north. And it seems to me...
yes, the north. It was above Watford, ergo.
Well, looking at the map for trains out of St Pancras, you would have had many opportunities to turn back, but you show great courage and you spurned the attractions of Bedfordshire, Nottingham, Leicestershire, Derbyshire, and you pressed on remorselessly to Sheffield in Yorkshire.
I did.
What on earth was the motivation for you to travel in this homage to Phileas Fogg?
Absolutely. My George Orwell moment, travelling up north. As I hinted at earlier on, It is the World Snooker Championships, which take place at the Crucible Theatre in Sheffield each year, and they climax on the first bank holiday Monday of May. That's when the final is. I've always really loved watching snooker, and I have a good friend called Lois who is an even bigger snooker nerd than me. She draws her own chart out on lined paper each year for the World Championships, and she's just so great. And we were watching the final. We usually watch the final together around someone's house, and we were watching it last year, and we talked about going, and I said, well, why don't we? And she went, oh, I'll look it up. And we bought tickets and we booked a hotel in advance, the Holiday Inn Express, because we got a discount off the hotel if we had snooker tickets. And we went and we watched four sessions of the quarterfinals of the World Snooker Championships. Oh, it was ever so good, Terence.
And you seem to have a great time looking at your references to it on social media.
On the soft meds, yes, I did. I was a bit of a pest on Instagram, but everyone was very nice about it. We had a lovely time in Sheffield. We really liked Sheffield as a city. We thought people were very welcoming. We some beautiful architecture of all sorts of different ages as well. Big fans of that. And of course, it was wonderful just to go and watch the snooker in the Crucible Theatre, which was well organised, I thought. And we bought our earpiece radios.
Oh, yes. So I saw people wearing those in the crowd. I was looking out for you, but I think you were too far back to be featured.
We were spotted, actually, in a crowd shot when they introduced the players for the evening session. On the social medias, there is a picture of me and a friend of mine rather undignifiedly yelling on Ronnie O'Sullivan when he was introduced to the thing. And my old secretary from a previous job took a picture and posted it on my Facebook and put, got ya. So, we watched an afternoon and an evening and then an afternoon and an evening. Slightly unluckily, the evening session we were watching yesterday, we had our best seats for row E and at table of finish, because Mark Selby had beaten Marco Fu by such a margin, there was no evening session. So we ended up watching the other table instead, which was Barry Hawkins versus Stephen Maguire. So we could still see it. And there were sort of screens around the arena and things, and the atmosphere was brilliant. And of course, the highlight of the whole trip was the fact that not only did we get to see two sessions of Ronnie O'Sullivan, who is my favourite and is the most, by far and away, the most popular there. I mean, the crowd are wild when O'Sullivan comes on. And he is, you know, the most talented player naturally, and we got to see him hit a 1-4-6 break, and that was really, really, really good. That was, he just missed a 1-4-7 by one. There was some speculation online that he'd missed it deliberately because of the prize money. He'd done that previously. He didn't. He genuinely overran and couldn't hit the black. But there was one lovely moment before that where it was obvious that he, you know, he'd gone past century. It was probably going to be, you know, he was on for the 1-4-7, and he had a couple of blacks left to go, I think. And he went down and went as if he was going to play the blue. And he lined up for it, and two or three people gasped, and he looked up and grinned, and then walked around and patted them. And it was a genuine moment of real fun. And you know, it was you know, we met some great people, and it was just, you know, a really enjoyable few days. And the staff at the Crucible are all spot on. One of the security men offered to take a picture of me and my friend at one point. It was oh, really. Lovely. It was, you know, it was really, and also we were in the crowd where we saw Jason Mohammed and Peter Ebdon and people like that do sort of live interviews in the stadium, and Rob Walker, the hype man, the intros man, did a lot of winding up of the crowd, which is really good. He dresses very smartly in what appears to be the same suit each day, and we had a wonderful time. I admit that the funny thing was, snooker's not to everyone's taste, but the funny one was, my friends were either, oh, that's nice that you're doing something that you like about the snooker. But the one or two that really got it, we have a friend called Neil, and he'd obviously worked the draw out, because we had to put the tickets blind. We didn't know who we were going to be seeing. We'd hoped to see O'Sullivan, but we didn't know if it was going to work out. On Friday evening, before we went, Neil walked into where I was DJing and greeted me with the words, "O'Sullivan, you're seeing O'Sullivan." Oh. So he got it and followed the draw and understood. But I think that lots of people have got in touch with me because they know that it's exciting. And actually, to be in the stadium, to take pictures of the table, and, you know, to sort of see. Also, had an experience. So it's on a big screen outside the theatre, so you can go and watch it on a big screen outside the theatre without having tickets, and enormous screen. And we were there, so our first tickets were for Tuesday afternoon session, which started at 2:30, so we got there and we were sort of investigating lunch options and things, and we were sitting watching the morning session, and things I thought would never happen, I looked up and said casually to my friend, "There's Ken Doherty," and she went, "Oh yeah, so it is." And Ken signed an autograph for someone and then walked off. And I never thought I'd be in a situation where I would casually see Ken Doherty just in general circulation and comment on that. And it was right. We also went to see them filming in the Winter Garden, which is where they do the daytime kind of bit where you see people playing on a table in the background and Hazel Irvine talks to. It was John Parrott and Ken Doherty.
Oh, yes, I saw that on TV. I wanted to ask you something about being in the arena. Some may possibly put forward the argument that tennis is the most cordial and genteel of sports, but after seeing and reading about the behaviour of Ilie Nastasi this week, that reputation's gone out the window. So I'm nominating snooker as the most polite and courteous sport on the planet, both players and supporters. Now, I watched a few of the frames that you were attending at the Crucible Theatre, like I said, trying to spot you in the crowd, and the audience behaviour was just about the most respectful you can achieve with a group of strangers placed together. And I was wondering whether that quiet hush maybe added to the level of tension in the sporting sense. I think it must be quite intimidating for some players because there's absolutely nothing else going on to distract the viewer, both in the venue and on TV. So perhaps only golf is similar in that we see one individual in close-up and there's absolutely nothing else or no one else to focus on.
Absolutely. It is so quiet to the point where actually one situation, the only situation where people did get a bit cross. So I mentioned these radios. So you buy a radio that's on like a, so it's an earpiece radio. It's a bit painful after four frames, I discovered, but you clip it round your ear. It's not great if you're a glasses wearer, actually, but you clip it round your ear. And it has two channels, so you can listen to one table or the other table. And it also converts, because it costs a tenner. I mean, it worked for us because we went to see four sessions, so actually it worked at a reasonably good value. And also, it converts into an FM radio as well. So actually, it's not bad for a tenner. And a nice man behind... Well, we had a problem in the last evening session we went to, and that we all had gold lanyards. They were all gold. And we'd seen a few people with red ones, and this chap in front of me had a blue one, and we couldn't work out why, because you couldn't buy different colours. That only came in gold. And this man was trying to get a signal to listen to the table, and it kept being really loud interference to the point where we heard it behind, and the people next to us frowned, and we said, God knows what it was like for him, because we could hear it really loud. It was really annoying, because there was no other noise, so this kind of burst of staticky feedback, it seemed like the loudest sound in the world, because it was so quiet. And at half time, a nice man behind me and his friend, who were from Wales, said, I'm not being funny, but next time that happens, would you mind awfully kicking him in the small of the back? And so I agreed I would. And I said, why won't it work? And this man said, and I wondered about this, because you'd think, oh, well, if they're selling radios to a tenner each, and I'd say 80% of the crowd had them at least, because it was good to be able to listen to the commentary, because you get the TV commentary on it, basically. Oh, so you listen to John Virgo and Dennis Taylor and people like that, which is why occasionally you hear the crowd laughing during the play, because we're laughing at something that's said on the thing. And so this chap said, they're like this for a whole season. So he said his was gold as well. And he said, I bought mine at the Players' Championship in Llandudno because they have World Snooker on them. Mm. And the World Championship is the climax of the season. And there are a number of what they call ranking events that the players play. And however you've done in the ranking events means that you're seeded for the World Championship. And you either get in automatically if you're top 16, or you have to go through the qualifiers, basically. So that's what happens. And he said that man's blue one is from a previous season that he's brought with him in the hope he can use again. And the man said they change the frequency every year, so you can't do that. But actually, it goes to show how quiet snooker is. That was, you know, genuinely terrible. And occasionally, you know, they have two. We were at the two table stage, so the semi-finals are today, and that's one table. But before that, there are two tables, and there's a screen up between the two, which means, of course, that if, for example, you're watching Ronnie O'Sullivan hit a 146, and the crowd get gradually louder and louder, more excited, the other table is still going on. And of course, at the end, when Ronnie hit the 146, we all erupted, and we were allowed about 30 seconds to a minute of eruption before we were all told by stewards and the referee to be quiet. And actually, the only way in which it isn't as respectful as tennis, and you say about the crowd behaviour, we were all told repeatedly to put phones onto silent at the beginning. I mean, repeatedly. And actually, the commentator said, just turn it off. You can't guarantee, because, of course, an alarm will go off even if it's silent. And there was an incident or two where phone went off. Not loudly, but it went off. And the referee would say instantly, turn that off after it stopped. At tennis, when someone's phone goes off, they make and you made me think of this, actually. You say tennis, the announcement goes, our phones turn off, please. And that announcement always clapped at Wimbledon. Everyone always, and I can never understand, people clap the person that tells you to tell your phone off. No one claps at snooker. So perhaps it's not quite as polite. But no, it is a very, like you said, very intense atmosphere. And when Ronnie was knocking in this 146, and also, he played badly in the middle session. So the first evening session that we saw him play, he didn't play very well at all. But at the end of the frame, the second session of four, because there are four frames and then a break and then another four frames. The last frame he played that evening, having not played terribly well, he put in a century in 3 minutes 56 seconds.
Wow.
And he just went, I mean, the 146 he did took about just over 6 minutes, and he was just firing round the table, and that was, you know, sort of, you could hear a pin drop, really, because everyone was just kind of waiting and watching for him to do it, really. So it is a curiously intense atmosphere. We were saying, actually, we did two sessions a day. There's a morning session as well. We avoided the morning session partly out of financial reasons, partly because we didn't necessarily want to have to rush to be there for 9:30 in the morning in a strange city. A new city. And also, we found ourselves very tired through watching two sessions a day. I know we weren't doing anything. We were knocking in 146s, but we were sat watching it because it was such a quiet and intense atmosphere. You know, yeah, you really are concentrating on one thing, and particularly if you've got the earpiece in as well and you are listening to what the commentators are saying, you're really immersed in it. It's such an immersive sport to watch. It's very calming. And I was explaining this. We were talking to someone there who was with a few people that had various sort of learning, not exactly learning disabilities, but perhaps, you know, had specific kind of needs. And we were because this person said, I was talking to someone, actually, when my friend was in the toilet, about they had a couple of people that had sort of Asperger's and were genuinely on the spectrum. And they said all of our kind of clients that we work for love snooker because it is the most orderly game there is. There is a set sequence that you have to follow every single time. You always have to follow the sequence. You have to pot reds and blacks, or reds and colours in sequence, and then the colours in sequence. It's not something you deviate from. You have to play that in order to win the game. But there are infinite variations in which you can get to that stage. And actually, they said that actually, in an increasingly disorderly world, a lot of their sort of people they work with love the fact that there is a very definite order. And also, some people on the spectrum find loud bursts of noise really difficult, and loud noise difficult. And snooker is the quietest sport there is.
Yeah.
My mum let us watch snooker when we were younger because she hated noise. I think I talked about the podcast before. She hated noise. I grew up thinking Formula One was took place in silence because we were never allowed the volume on. Snooker, she absolutely loves because it is, you know, long periods of silence, and it's a very reflective game, I think, in a lot of ways. And there's always an argument whether it's a sport or not. And, you know, there are some people that were shaped like sportsmen and there were some people that were not. But it's a great, you know, it's a great game. And we were very fortunate to see people at the top of their game. And we met some really nice people. I mean, I have to say, a lot of it did make me giggle when we drank in pubs near to the cruising pool. We saw an awful lot of men of a certain age in slightly retro sports ways shaking each other's hand. I mean, we saw a lot of that. That was how the crowds interacted with each other. But no, it was a really interesting week. And Sheffield was a very welcoming city, and we would definitely go back there. It was even the chain pubs were interesting pubs. We went into a couple of pubs thinking they were spoons, and they weren't with spoons, but they were it was, you know, it was a really interesting, and sort of people heard our southern accents and asked if we were up for the snooker, and so we got to have a bit of a kind of a chat about that. If people like snooker and have the money's available to do it, I would recommend it because it was really, really interesting and really fun.
Well, I'm glad you had a really good time, and I'm glad you're back safe and sound as well.
Thank you, Terence. We got, despite me getting on the wrong train on the way up there, we did manage to make it back safely, so that was good. Supervised by Nod.
In an age where 74-year-old Paul McCartney announces another rather exhausting-looking world tour, and 82-year-old Mary Berry is one of our most popular television presenters.
Yes.
When do we become old? That's next after The Cure. I almost literally bumped into Robert Smith a few years ago. He was with the hair, but without makeup, coming out of a shop in Littlehampton in your Sussex, of all places.
Indeed, yes, West Sussex.
He's the birthday boy this week, 58 on April 21st. That was from a box set, Join the Dots, B-Sides and Rarities, The Cure and Purple Haze. Now, we're at 58, Robert Smith is 3 years behind me, and I've no idea of his views on the ageing process. But I think for the first time this week, I've decided I am officially old, because I was looking at some fashion items currently widely available for you young people, and it struck me...
I often object to being... We'll talk about this, but to being the... I am the relative young person on this. I'm not a young person in any other circumstance.
It struck me that the world has officially gone mad. When you feel that way, then I think, you know, you're truly past it. I bring you two items available on the high street that I don't think you're going to see me flaunting this summer.
That's a disappointment already.
Even if I am beach body ready, I shan't be flaunting these. Here are the Moto clear plastic jeans from Topshop. These are called window jeans because you can see right through them. They're plastic, they're see-through. £49 in the UK, $100 from Topshop in the USA. And I also put forward to you from the good people of Nordstrom, the Barracuda straight leg jeans. What's the big deal with them, you may ask? The Barracuda jeans come with mud and dirt painted on to give, and I quote, a caked-on muddy coating to evoke a rugged Americana workwear vibe. And these mud-caked jeans are a real bargain. £351 in the UK, $425 in America. Jules, I must be old because I would wear long johns under the plastic window jeans and chuck the Barracuda muddy jeans in the washing machine, or more likely, I think, in the bin.
Well, I think I'll probably join you in the refuge area of my building, throwing clothes into the bins. Yeah, it's maybe it's not so much the fact that we're old, but the fact that we maybe being young and following fashion means that you know, you have not lived a life. You are more likely to fall for the Emperor's New Clothes syndrome, maybe, because you haven't got the perspective, in this case, you know, literally Emperor's New Clothes, because you haven't, in terms of the clear jeans, very much so, because you haven't got that kind of perspective. I don't want to call it wisdom, but I think that one's BS, I won't sort of fill that out because this is a family podcast, but one's BS radar I think improves as one, not necessarily, it doesn't mean aging necessarily, getting older, but one's experience of life increases, which inevitably comes with getting older, I suppose. But yeah, I mean, we often talk about whether or not I am young, and does not being young anymore mean that one has responsibilities and fiscal commitments, which means I cannot spend £450 on the muddy jeans because I have a service charge to pay, Terence, damn it, and a mortgage. I'm not sure when one becomes old. I think in a way, I think one becomes old when I think that to balance off not falling for things that are obviously nonsense, like the muddy jeans, you also have with that, I think, it's about staying relevant. Doesn't mean necessarily falling for the latest young hip thing, but staying relevant, I think, means you're not repeating the same thing over and over again. And I find figures like Ray Davis, for example, and Ronnie Wood and people like that, who are still trying to be sort of young, wild rock stars and that sort of thing, I find them to be far less relevant than I did, for example, people like David Bowie, who stayed very sort of quote-unquote young because he did some really interesting material. I mean, he did quite a lot of drum and bass influence stuff in the late 90s, and it was sort of a return to form for him, really. And so I find people... I don't think people get irrelevant because they are old, but I think I think they become irrelevant because they're trying to stay young. Or what they perceive to be young, I suppose, really. And so I suppose Mary Beth, but then having said that, I might go back on myself again about this, because but being relevant doesn't necessarily mean following every trend, I suppose, really. Mary Berry has not really changed what she's done for donkey's years. You mentioned her at the beginning. But it seems there is that old adage that if you don't follow fashion, eventually fashion will follow you. And Mary Berry's always had, you know, good solid level success as a cookery writer and occasional presenter. She never changed what she's done, particularly. That's never something that's changed. Yet now, all of a sudden, there have been far more population, you know, far more popularity around that. So I don't know, Terence. It's an interesting puzzle.
Yeah, I find it a very peculiar business, because age, obviously, is a state of mind in our era. It would have been unthinkable for anyone over the age of 40 to go and see pop groups a generation back.
Oh, absolutely,
but now, mums and dads accompany their children to Glastonbury, and I think the people queuing outside shops for Record Store Day are more likely to be of senior years than teenagers.
So yes, I think so.
I'm all in favour of staying young in that sense. I mean, whilst you can still do it, whatever it may be, carry on, is my view, which is why, I've noticed this time around there's a lot of people saying about Paul McCartney, as my other earlier example, that in his now mid-70s his voice is nowhere near as strong as it used to be, he should call it a day. I don't think so. You know, if he's enjoying it and it's still bringing a lot of fun and enjoyment to people who go and see, and as I've been to Paul McCartney gigs in the last couple of years where, you know, people are genuinely in tears with happiness at the hearing the songs played live, carry on. You're a long time, as they say, underground, aren't you? So
yes,
carry on and do what you've got to do.
Although equally it becomes a bit frustrating when slots at festivals that might otherwise be taken by up-and-coming bands, gig bookings that might be taken by up-and-coming bands, I don't want to use the phrase bed blocking because it's horrible, but in the past, in the 60s, for example, and then the 70s, you had new generations coming up all the time, didn't you? And people retired. I mean, I can't imagine how Paul McCartney and the Stones and the Kinks would have felt if they were trying to get bookings at large venues and large festivals in the late 60s and Max Bygraves was still touring, or whoever it was from the 30s and 40s. No, I'm sorry, Paul McCartney. We can't, and John Lennon, we can't book the Beatles to headline, you know, the Glastonbury Fair this year because we've got Vera Lynn instead. I mean, you know, it does feel a little bit like, yeah, it's great that these people are still going, and, you know, perhaps, you know, maybe that the nostalgia is no bad thing, but when that's all it is, when that's all the big bands and all of the big festivals and the big arena tours are by these people, you might say, oh, it's because there is no one as good that's come up. But equally, maybe they haven't had the opportunities to do so because there's still this top layer at the top that won't go.
Yeah, I take your point. You may be right, but as ever, supply and demand, isn't it? Whatever will sell out there. You know, I don't think Jake Bugg could sell out arenas right across America. All power to his elbow, but I don't think he could. Yeah. Whereas Paul McCartney and the Stones and the Eagles still can, and Fleetwood Mac can. So that's probably why they're still in those stadiums, because the number of acts that can sell that number of seats is very small. I've got a question for you. What I want to know is, will you be wearing window jeans at your public appearances this week?
You know, as much as I'm sure everybody in Hastings wants to see my bum, equally, no one in Hastings should really, because, you know, the world is difficult enough at present. This week, public appearance-wise, I believe I am doing a Saturday social? I can't remember. I might be doing a Saturday social this week. It's every other week, and I get a bit confused.
People should follow you on Twitter. If they follow you on Twitter, they'll find out if you're doing a radio show this week.
SuperJews84, that's me. Hello. But I am doing Indie Wonderland next Wednesday. That's the thing that's definitely happening. Indie Wonderland is on Barricade Radio from 8 until 10 p.m. on Wednesday evening, barricaderadio.com. And also, we've talked previously about things that go on in Hastings. It is the Jack in the Green Festival in Hastings, because it is the first bank holiday in May. There are things going on over the whole weekend, lots of bands playing locally, loads of it, there's a lot of Morris dancing. And it climaxes in a festival on Monday. There's a big long parade that goes on through the town and ends up on the West Hill, where again there is a lot of Morris dancing. But there's a lot of really interesting people in the parade, and it's a really, really fun kind of weekend. So it attracts tourists from all over the world, and there's also an enormous motorbike rally and scooter rally that takes place as well on the seafront. So there's a lot of fun to be had in Hastings this bank holiday weekend.
That sounds good. Huge thanks to the Flora McDonald of this podcast, executive producer Rona. And
Rona, yes.
I believe we're playing out with the King of Sampling.
Yes, we are. And I know that you dislike instrumentals, but there is a little bit of talking on this.
This is very well done on this track. Yeah.
Yes. A concession. I knew it would happen. I knew you'd crack eventually. I was DJing at a public appearance recently as a guest DJ with Wow and Flutter, the record shop in Hastings that have a live DJing operation. Myself and Tim from Wow and Flutter played together. And it was a 5-hour set. And it wasn't very busy at the beginning, which meant that we kind of played for ourselves for a bit and took interesting detours. And I recently bought, from Tim, Susan, funnily enough, a pressing of DJ Shadow's second album. This comes from his second album. Introducing, as you say, was sort of genre-defining, and it created a culture, I think, in that it was the first album to be made entirely from samples and sold extremely well. This was the follow-up called The Private Press, which had some original material on it as well. I was an enormous fan of it at university. I listened to it constantly. It must have come out in about 2002. It was occasionally the choice of the laid-back student. There might have been reasons why some of those students might have been laid back, but it was very much that kind of culture. And I bought a copy on double vinyl from Tim and Susan recently. It's extremely rare because the labels are printed wrong. Which apparently gives it extra value. But I played this when we were DJing live together, and several people came up to us to ask us what it was, because it's such an unusual record, but I think it is so good. And I love the fact that it is about DJing as well at the beginning, and is talking about DJing and deciding what to pick. So it's sort of a meta choice this week. But this is DJ Shadow, and this is Write a Thing / GDMFSOB.
This tape collection gets bigger every minute. I find it very hard to fit the music to the mood, and there's nothing worse than to make the wrong choice, except to sort right through and find nothing suitable. But then I find just the right thing. But then I find just the right thing. But then I find just the right thing, 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 but then I find just the right thing.
have been listening to a DACA Media production.